Hi, I'm Adrienne Hill, in for Tess Bigland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of July 13th, 2012. Today, we're going to talk oldies but goodies, seniors. Yep, Mom and Dad, that's you. You and a whole lot of other people. As baby boomers grow up, the number of seniors in this country is ballooning. On today's show, we'll talk about the financial hurdles of being grandma and grandpa.
We've heard about the sandwich generation where the parents are having to take care of their parents and then their children.
Right.
Now they're taking care of their grandkids as well. I call it the club sandwich generation. You got to add another layer in there.
Why helping out too much could put retirement at risk. Plus, one family's journey to assisted living.
I drove into the glass window of a store that was empty, thank goodness. And I realized that driving is not for me anymore.
Finding a new home for an older parent. Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from 8 p.m. To start us off, we thought we'd get a quick hit of the headlines affecting seniors, so we asked Mark Garrison to join us. He's the newest member of our New York Bureau, and I guess today he's, well, our senior reporter. Hey, Mark.
So I just started this job, and I thought my title was reporter, but apparently you have the power to promote me. I'm pretty excited about this.
You know,
did I just get a raise?
So wish I did, and you didn't. But it is great that you're here. You should feel really good about yourself. Congratulations on being here. You're awesome.
Okay. You're not saying I look old, though, right?
By not
a senior
at all.
Reporter?
Not
okay.
At all.
All right. Just checking with that. All right. Let's look at some of the news. A new study out of Bowling Green State University shows the divorce rate among Americans over 50 has doubled in the last two decades.
What's going on with that?
Well, it doesn't look at causes, so we don't
okay.
know that. They're just kind of looking at the trend, which was kind of alarming. But what a lot of people who are sociologists who are looking at this, what they're saying is that it seems that as baby boomers age, they're carrying their social acceptance of divorce with them. And now we're seeing the impact in the numbers.
And maybe they're just getting tired of each other. Did you see this story about these tortoises who'd basically been tortoise married for 115 years.
Okay.
And recently they broke up. They started fighting. They had to separate them. That was it. After 115 years of marriage.
I'm going to confess that my subscription to the Tortoise Love Journal has lapsed. I don't know if Marketplace has a subscription. Clearly
I've
they do.
I've got it on my desk.
You have
yeah,
really
I've
kept
got
up
it on
with
my
these
desk.
Issues. But yeah, tortoise divorce. I mean, because again, lawyers, they're paid by the hour and tortoises move pretty slowly. So I feel like that's, you know, the lawyer is really going to drag that one out. I'm sure those two tortoises are paying some big bills right now. All right, some other research out there in the news this week that definitely captured the imagination of our Marketplace colleagues because it seems to give the advice that women should be drinking more.
Do tell more, please.
Get more to that in a minute. But this is about rheumatoid arthritis and osteoporosis. These
okay.
affect millions of older women. And it turns out that moderate drinking. We'll stress
that
a lot.
He says as he underlines
yes,
in the
no,
air.
I did a hand underline. Thanks for bringing that to the people out there in audio land. But that can reduce the risk for both of these diseases. Now, again, this caught a lot of attention, as we said, at Marketplace. I'll quote our colleague who is not an older woman, Millie Jefferson, but she says, quote, "I'm going to have the most bone ever!" Exclamation point. Now, let's remind ourselves that these studies come out a lot. They get a lot of attention, and people who really love to overdo it on the weekend with liquid enjoyment, they like to just use this to justify their debauchery. This is a problem because, again, moderation. Did I mention moderation?
You
as,
did.
As part
yes,
of this?
I okay. remember that.
Yeah. Talk to your doctor before you go on any course of, you know, boozy self-medication because,
again,
a bottle
of wine a night maybe not the best idea.
Yeah. Remember, beyond moderation, beyond that, there are other problems you're going to introduce. So you will not get the benefit if you go further like that. And obviously, there are other ways, healthy lifestyle choices that you can do that are better than just drinking more.
Thanks, Mark. And welcome to Marketplace.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also in the senior news lineup this week, a new scam where bad guys claim there's a government program in place to help pay your utility bill. All you have to do is pass over your social security number, a little personal information, and they've got you. For more, we asked Bill Cressy to join us. He's director of the Center for the Study of Fraud and Corruption at St. Xavier University in Chicago. Hi, Bill. Thanks for being here.
Great being here.
So how much do scams cost us every year?
Due to the nature of fraud, it's hard to determine, but our best estimate is a study that's done every 2 years by the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, and we figure it comes close to the $1 trillion mark.
With a T.
With a T, yes.
And who's getting scammed out of all of that money?
Everyone. consumers are, anyone who uses credit, anyone who hires someone because they've had fraudulent resumes foisted on them. We're all victims, and fraud never sleeps. So we must always be vigilant about fraud.
Are seniors more susceptible to scams than other people?
They are. In fact, we did a study analyzing identity theft in the city of Chicago where we looked over tens of thousands of identity theft cases. And we actually found that demographically, senior citizens reported fraud cases a lot less. But our speculation on that is senior citizens have reason not to report, because too often when a senior tells their family that they've been scammed, too often the family looks at them as, well, they're no longer competent to handle their affairs. So seniors have a reason not to report when they're defrauded. And as a result, the professional fraudsters target seniors because they know that even if they're found out, there's a very good possibility that the senior will not call the police.
What are the implications of that if seniors don't want to admit to their family members that they've been scammed?
Well, I think the real lesson here is that people should understand that if their relative or if their their parent or senior citizen relative is scammed, it does not mean that they're no longer competent to handle their affairs. What it means is that because they are a senior, they have been targeted. And one of the reasons that they're targeted is because of the prejudice that a lot of us younger folks have about senior citizens. That the moment that they get scammed, we conclude, well, they're incompetent. We're going to have to take over their affairs. All of us should talk to our senior citizen relatives and parents and say, look, be careful with your money. But if something does happen, please know you can come to us.
Now, how have these scams and frauds changed over time?
It's amazing. A good professional fraudster keeps up on current events and is a real student of human behavior. They know how people will react.
So these are thought out things. This is like a smart guy in a room coming up with a smart idea.
Oh, yeah. And very often these are, if you will, roving gangs of fraudsters who travel the country. And once they come up with a good fraud, they will, go from one coast to the other, perpetrating the fraud across the country.
That's kind of terrifying.
Yes, it is.
Now, who are these really clever fraudsters out there doing this stuff?
As I say, there is a professional cadre of fraudsters, but they really only make up about 5% of total fraudsters. The vast majority of people who are ever convicted of fraud crimes never have been convicted of any crime previously. And from the study that we did here in Chicago of identity thieves, they're people that know you. They're your friends and relatives. After all, your Uncle Fred knows your mother's maiden name.
Right.
Every time you open your wallet, you're putting your identity and your financial well-being at risk. Please, people, do not have your Social Security card in your wallet.
What advice do you have for making yourself scam-proof, especially for seniors out there?
First of all, so many scams, such as the utility scam, is conducted over the phone. If you're ever contacted over the phone by someone who says that they're the government or your bank or whoever, and they sound just credible enough that you go along with their pitch, but then they ask for identifying information, an account number, your Social Security number, even such things as, phone numbers or mother maiden name or things of this nature. No bank, no government agency, no utility company will contact you and ask you for information that they should already have. And if they do, the easiest thing to do is say, well, thanks for calling. I've got to run now, and hang up. And definitely, if you get any sort of call that President Obama just signed a bill to pay for utility bills, no, he didn't.
That bill does not exist.
It's a scam. Don't believe it.
Bill Cressy is the director of the Center for the Study of Fraud and Corruption at St. Xavier University in Chicago. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
For just a minute here, we're going to move away from seniors and retirees and talk about people who are still working, or at least trying to find work. Laura Doyle lives in the Oak Forest suburb of Chicago. She and her husband have both been out of work for many months, and it's put a strain on her family, particularly her relationship with her teenage daughter. So Laura decided to write a letter.
Dear daughter, as you know, your father was laid off 3 years ago. I went back to work to make ends meet, but I too fell victim to the Great Recession and lost my job on your little sister's birthday. 7 days before that, we lost our health insurance. But as parents, it is your father's and my job to protect you. When Daddy's unemployment ran out, he withdrew funds from his pension to keep a roof over our heads. It took me an entire year to convince the Department of Human Services we were poor enough to qualify for welfare. I hope you never know the shame of that, or the shame of being 40 years old and having to ask your mother if you can borrow $20 to put gas in your car. I never wanted you to know that I spent my birthday money on your graduation dress, or that Daddy and I have not exchanged Christmas gifts for 3 years. But what I do want you to know is that we are not the only people on this boat. Many people are unemployed, and every one of us is doing what we can to get by. You say our chauffeur services are at your disposal just because all your friends' parents have real jobs, whereas Dad and I just sit around all day and watch TV, as you put it. Who do you think cleans the house, makes dinner, and mows the lawn? Leprechauns? And all those times that you cried your friends got to go on all those cool vacations and we suck because we never go anywhere? Did you know that I cried too because I was ashamed I can't give you those things? Every single thing your father and I do is for you and your brother and sister, if only for the sole purpose that you will one day leave this house better and stronger for having lived through it. You are the reason I get out of bed in the morning. I love you more than life itself. I need you to respect that. I need your respect, period. I need you to know that someday it will be better. Maybe not today, but someday. Love, Mom.
It turns out Laura's someday is just around the corner. Her letter was published a couple weeks ago in the Chicago Sun-Times, and James McClelland, the CEO of a local property management company, read the letter and called her in for a job interview. She starts Monday. Well, it's time for your letters now, and our senior producer, Patty Hirsch, has been digging through the mail this week. Welcome, Patty.
Hello, thank you.
And all the way from New York, we've got investing diva and editor-at-large at CBSMoneyWatch.com, Jill Schlesinger. Hey, Jill.
Hey, diva, huh? Okay, I'll take it.
Work with it. So, Patty, start us off. What do we got this week?
Well, first off, we have a clarification. Last week, our other favorite guest host, Sarah Gardner, was talking about travel advice for people with disabilities, and when she said that be prepared was the motto of the Boy Scouts. Well, listener Kathy Poltz from San Diego wrote in to remind us that be prepared is actually the motto of both the Boy and the Girl Scouts.
Well, nice work clearing that up.
Well, so a lot of scouting parents listen to this show. So it's important we get these things right. Right, Jill?
Absolutely. I got kicked out of the Girl Scouts, I just want to say.
Why doesn't that surprise me?
I know. I was overly aggressive. I know that's shocking.
It wasn't your knots then.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
And be prepared. It's a good motto for us, too. So thank you to Kathy. What else you got in there, Patty?
Well, we have a letter from Lisa Heimbach from Durham, North Carolina. She wants to buy some savings bonds for her goddaughter. But to do that, she's got to get the girl's social security number, right? But Lisa's obviously the sort of personal finance maven who understands the need to guard one's social security number carefully.
With their life.
Right. So she doesn't want to ask the girl's parents to disclose that information. It's very polite of her. So she wants to know, is there any kind of long-term bond that she can buy as a gift without the recipient's SSN? Jill?
That's a tough one. If you want the bond to be in the kid's name, then no, it's really hard. And to get something put into somebody else's name, it requires a social security number. So if you go on to a site like where you can go to treasurydirect.gov and you want to purchase something, there's always going to be the requirement of a social security number. But I think there could be a little bit of a workaround here. One is that, maybe she just buys the bond in her own name. Mm-hmm. And she makes it a transfer on death account, which means she'll pass that security to the kid upon her death. And maybe when the kid's older, she just will transfer it and say, here, I'm gifting it to you anyway.
But, and then she can transfer it under her own social security number.
Correct.
Right.
And that might avoid it. But I wouldn't get too flipped out about giving your social security number to Treasury Direct, because frankly, it's a very easy way to buy a security. And it's the Treasury Department. They've got that social security number already.
Fair enough.
All right. So we got several letters from listeners this week, all asking about cashing in their 401ks. Matthew Rokowski from Collingswood, New Jersey, was considering cashing in part of his retirement investment to help his bride-to-be pay down some student loans. And another caller, who wanted to remain nameless, wanted to cash in on his 401k to raise money to make a down payment on a house. What do you think about raiding your 401k, Jill?
Oh, gosh, I was
you
groaning.
You could see on Patty's face this was
groaning.
He knew
here.
The answer, yes.
But yeah, the first one about paying down debt, absolutely not a wise idea to take money out of your 401k to do that. Now, that said, especially for someone else, as much as you love your honey, if you were really at the end of your rope and you said, I'm paying 29% in this credit card account, and I have a whole bunch of money in my 401k, what might be advisable would be to take a loan out against your 401k and pay off the credit card debt, and then you'll pay your loan back to your employment plan. The downside of a 401k loan is, number one, it's usually limited to $50,000. That's first of all. But number two, when you actually leave a job, you've got to repay that loan in full. So if you lost your job, not for your own, you know, you're laid off or your division shuts down, all of that money is due at once. And so you could be right back where you started, which is getting a credit card to pay off that 401k loan.
Ouch.
So
yeah.
If you don't pay back the loan, remember it's a distribution. Very, very painful distribution, which would be taxed at your ordinary income rate, and you pay a penalty because you're under the age of 59 and a half.
So bad idea.
Bad idea. Now, I will also say that for a down payment of a house, I despise the idea of taking my money out of my retirement for a down payment on the house. People do it all the time. I think it's terrible. I think that you've got to be able to plan ahead and you've got to get that money set aside. And if you don't have your down payment already, and because it's, you know, you've saved too much in your 401k, then delay purchasing the home. Don't raid your retirement account to buy a house.
Okay. All right. So this show is all about seniors and financial issues they face. And Abby Martin from Waitsfield, Vermont, wrote in to ask us about estate planning for her parents. I think we have her on the line now. Hi, Abby.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
So tell us a few things about yourself, Abby.
I'm in my early 20s, and I do marketing and outreach for a school in Vermont that teaches sustainable building and design.
And right. So what's your question? What do you want Jill and Patty to weigh in on here?
Well, I've been thinking about my parents as they get older. They're both retired. They're right around 60, and I'm an only child, so I've been thinking about how I can help them get ready for the inevitable. You know, I hope I hope their deaths are a long way off, but I have some idea of documents that we should all have for medical planning. But I don't really know what sorts of things I should help them get together in the financial realm. So it'd be great to start with even just a checklist and go from there.
Is there a checklist, Jill?
Have I got a checklist for you, Abby? It's like you're a plant. It's fabulous. The reason why I'm laughing about this is it's sort of a sad thing. I actually created a blog post about this after my father-in-law died last summer because I mean, I used to be a financial planner, so I knew all the documents. Like you said, Abby, like you kind of know it's the will, it's the power of attorney, it's the healthcare proxy. You know all of those things. You even know the do not resuscitate stuff. Those are the things that everybody talks about. But gosh, when my father-in-law died, I learned about all the different other pieces that maybe I should have known about earlier, but you kind of only know when you go through it yourself. So what I think is really important is lists. I know this sounds crazy. It's like the checklist manifesto here. But you want a list of every bank account that is outstanding. You need a list of all the username and passwords, right? Because so many of us do online banking. You want a list of automatic pay accounts with name and contact information of each payee, a list if there's some safe deposit box. You want the list of your 401ks and your IRAs, pensions, annuities, all of that stuff. One huge sticking point for people, savings bonds. A lot of older people have not converted to the electronic world and have all these paper savings bonds floating around. Get them. Have a detailed list. Have your life insurance policies, your long-term care policies, all of that stuff. If you don't know where it is just maddening to try to track it down later.
Have you made any kind of inroads into that, Abby?
I haven't. That's a great suggestion.
And Abby, how do these conversations go with your parents?
Well, you know, it's not something we've talked about that much. I'm 23 and they're, you know, just about 60. And so it's kind of something that we're hoping is a long way off. But I have had two of my grandparents have died within the last decade. Hmm. And I've been kind of watching them follow through all the estate work and so on. And that's part of what got me thinking about this. I have to admit that being off at college and living away from home and so on, it's not something that we talk about very much because it doesn't come up in day-to-day conversations that I have with them. But one of the things I'm hoping for also is that you might give me a little bit of advice for having these conversations.
Well, I was just going to say, it's always a very sticky for kids to bring this up because I think parents are a little bit, you know, freaked out about it themselves. The time where it often will make sense is when there's nothing critical going on, when everything's really great. And so it could be as benign as you saying, you know, I was listening to the radio this weekend and on Marketplace Money, they had this really interesting segment about the estate planning. How have you guys managed your estate planning? Because obviously I'm the only child, so I want to make sure you guys are all set so this doesn't fall like through the cracks. So what can I do to help you out or tell me what you've done? If you feel really weird about it, the other way to do it is to enlist somebody who is close to them, a financial advisor, a CPA, an attorney, and or use some trigger event. Hey, the estate laws are going to change at the end of this year. You guys have all your estate stuff done, right? We call that the assumptive close in sales. And take them off the hook. I mean, if they're weirded out by the whole process, you want to say, oh, my God, of course, I think it's so strange. Also, I just been thinking about it because, you know, I love you so much. And it's my understanding that, you know, when these documents are done really perfectly and spot on, it leaves all of the people who are left behind able to just concentrate on what they want to do, which is mourning their loved ones, right? Not settling the estate, because settling an estate is a pain in the neck.
Is this a conversation that should be taken out over breakfast or over dinner, do you think?
I'm thinking it may not be over a meal because it's a little, you know, let's talk about your death. I don't know. It doesn't make me want to eat. I'm thinking that it's at home and it's in a nice environment when everyone's feeling good. It can happen when somebody you know dies. I mean, a lot of people will have these conversations because they'll say, you might say, Abby, like, hey, my friend's father just died and boy, she's going through a lot. Let me tell you what happened.
Yeah, and I really appreciate advice on the conversation because the medical questions are a little easier to bring up, actually. You know, the financial stuff is always a little bit sticky because it's both death and money, which are things people don't like to talk about.
Right, maybe you could ask them about sex also while you're at it, just a triple play, you know?
All right, well, on that note.
Thank you so much, Abby.
Thank you.
And thank you, Patty and Jill.
Thanks, Adrian.
Thanks, Adrian.
And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners, about any money problem or question or conundrum you've been pondering. We're on Facebook, on Twitter, or you can click Contact Us at Marketplace.org.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace Podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Last week, we asked you to write in and pass on any nuggets of financial wisdom you've gleaned from grandparents over the years. We got dozens of responses on Twitter, on Facebook, and email. Some of those were touching. Some were blunt. Almost all were useful. So we called a few of you up and asked you to share.
My name is Josette Cassier, and I live in Bossier City, Louisiana. my husband's grandfather gave us the three rules for a happy marriage. Number one, never live with in-laws. Number two, never buy anything on credit. And number three, as soon as you realize you can't pay a debt that you owe, contact your creditor and explain the situation, and then make arrangements to either reduce the payment or delay the payment. Do this before you miss your payment.
Richard Becker, Madison, Wisconsin. Mima inspired me to be a flinty, parsimonious New Englander. Her mantra was, use it up, wear it out, and make do without.
George Patrick McLear from Greenville, South Carolina. The best piece of financial advice my grandparents gave me, money isn't important, who you help is.
This is Polly Carolyn. I'm from Las Vegas, Nevada, and the best piece of financial advice I got from my grandparents was, you watch the nickels and dimes, and the dollars roll along by themselves.
But those nickels and dimes and dollars can be hard to come by for people out of work, especially older workers. Take people 55 and older. If they lose a job, they are, on average, out of work for a year. That's many months longer than younger people. And finding that next job can take more than time. As Marketplace's John Dimsdale tells us, it sometimes requires a whole lot of creativity.
Older workers face extra challenges when they lose a job. It's harder to convince employers they're a good long-term investment when it comes to training and likely healthcare costs. Plus, elderly workers don't have as much time to earn back their lost salary.
There's been a lot of research done on the scarring effects of losing one's job.
That's Matt Rutledge, an economist at the Center for Retirement Research.
And they found that as much as a 25% reduction in earnings going forward about 5 or 6 years, and more than a quarter of older workers who lost their job actually had their earnings halved in their next job.
Fred Sanford knows all this firsthand. Right around 2004, after 18 years in the mortgage business in the Chicago area, Sanford decided to hitch his career to the booming market for financial planners in sunny Orlando, Florida.
I'm a people person, so the relationship part of it and my financial part of it and everything else just seemed like the perfect culmination of everything that I had done in the past was pointing to this is going to be great.
He was 53, and he found plenty of customers willing to entrust their nest eggs to his financial planning expertise.
So by about my third year into the business, I had collected about $22 million and had a nice client base starting, and then the meltdown happened in 2008.
He soon lost his job with Merrill Lynch, and his customers, having been burned by the stock market, no longer wanted his expertise.
Also, it was difficult because nobody had an appetite for risk anymore. So that kind of did me in. I was between that rock and a hard place, like lost business, can't get new business. I tried everything. I would organize seminars for attorneys and for other specialized groups, and nobody came.
Sanford looked unsuccessfully for work for 2 years. His wife took a job with the school system to secure health insurance, and that's when Sanford took inspiration from his grandfather, who was the third national president of the AARP, then known as the American Association for Retired Persons.
He went and traveled all around the world espousing his philosophy that instead of retire and sleep on the couch and disappear, that you need to redirect and reinvent who you are and become active and become a giver, not a taker, and become productive and be somebody that you can use your experience in your lifetime.
Music had been Sanford's passion since his days playing in a college band. His involuntary long-term unemployment allowed plenty of time for thinking about that.
You know, when you work at something for a long time, your identity is so tied to what you do. And it's very interesting how over a period of time, when you're not doing that, that you're kind of saying, well, who am I again? It's a self-examination time that I think is quite healthy. And it also turns on your creative juices.
With those juices flowing, Sanford bought a state-of-the-art PA system and a keyboard and put together a repertoire of songs.
I started working at those wine bars, and I started having a great time, and I started feeling that identity of positive energy again.
All of me, why not take...
In the bars and nightclubs, he discovered his performances were little more than background music. He found a better alternative in doing one-hour shows in area retirement communities, and he convinced his wife to join in.
Thank you so much, and thank you for allowing us the opportunity to perform for you this evening. We are Fred and Kathy Sanford, husband and wife for the last 37 years.
I love that generation because they appreciate what you do, and we just have really come to like playing for that audience because they're so much more cultured and responsive.
He was a famous trumpet man from our Chicago way.
Sanford says reinvention is the only way to cope with global economic forces beyond his control.
I've seen so many people who have become long-term unemployed that have decided to do what's fun and do what they're passionate about and turning that into a business. And we're seeing a tremendous resurgence of the entrepreneurial spirit, and it's maybe necessity is the mother of invention here.
The retirement community gigs are infrequent, 3 or 4 a month. Sanford knows it'll never pay all the bills.
No, I'm a realist. What I look to do is just try and be productive, carry my weight, earn a living.
Sanford turned 60 this month. He and his wife live in a nice house, thanks in part to his wife's school job and to a lifetime of avoiding debt and making good investments. Unemployment forced them to downsize their financial dreams for retirement, but they've been able to upsize their passion for what it will become. In Orlando, Florida, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
A few weeks ago, Anne Marie Slaughter wrote a controversial piece in The Atlantic about women and how we balance family and work. She got a lot of response, including this economic take from commentator Diane Lim Rogers.
Anne Marie Slaughter recently wrote in The Atlantic a piece entitled, Why Women Still Can't Have It All. My response, of course we can't have it all, and that's a good thing. I haven't always felt this way. From my teens into adulthood, I had a wish list. College, check. Grad school, check. Marriage, check. Good job, check. Kids, check. Check, check, check. Yep, today I have 4 kids, and I work full-time as an economist in Washington, D.C. But on the way to ticking all these boxes, I didn't really stop to think about why, or how that superficial list translated into my internal happiness. It took me 20-plus years of marriage to realize that the best thing I could say about my marriage was how long it had lasted. That's sort of like saying the best thing about the Bush tax cuts is how large they are and how long they have lost us so much revenue. I have since gotten divorced. The mom in me may still feel pressure from society to have it all, to take care of everything. But the economist in me remembers the law of diminishing marginal utility, that if we could really have it all, whatever we had last obtained wouldn't be worth anything to us. Constraints that prevent us from having it all also force us to prioritize, to choose whatever gives us the greatest value first. Individuals can't do everything we are good at, or even best at. A concept economists call comparative advantage applies here. I might have inherent absolute advantage in terms of my skills as an economist over some men and women who have more successful careers as economists than I. But my greatest comparative advantage, absolutely, is as mom to my own kids. That's especially true now that they are ages 13 to 20 when they really need me, and not 0 to 7 when any smiling face with food at the ready would do. Being just mom is where I am both providing the greatest value and obtaining my greatest joy. So women and anyone shouldn't be sad about not being able to have it all. It only means we have to settle for having what makes us happiest.
Diane Lim Rogers is chief economist at the Concord Coalition.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
When it comes to taking care of elderly parents, you can have them move in with you. Someone can come to their house and help out. They're assisted living facilities, or if they need a whole lot of help, nursing homes. But most of these options aren't cheap. Assisted living costs about $40,000 a year. A nursing home, about twice that. And this week, I thought we'd go check out what that money bought. So I headed up the road to Pasadena, where I met 90-year-old Ann Somer and her daughter Robin at the Pasadena Highlands Assisted Living Facility. Do you mind showing me around the apartment? I don't know who's...
So we have this terrace that she never goes out on.
Ann's got a bedroom, a bathroom. It's simply furnished. A needlepoint on the wall that she did years ago. Photos of the family.
And Robin is there. You see that picture in the corner there with Robin in full costume?
And Anne shows me one of her dearest possessions, a coffee table that's moved with her from New York to Florida and now to California.
I have a very affectionate feeling for this table. It made me feel at home.
But making the move into this new home wasn't an easy decision. It took years of talking and an accident.
I was driving, and unfortunately, my foot went on the gas pedal instead of the brake. And I was going to a beauty parlor, and I drove into the glass window of a store that was empty, thank goodness. And I realized that driving is not for me anymore. And that sort of did it for me, and I realized I couldn't stay there.
Anne went to the hospital. She wasn't hurt, but she says she knew she couldn't be alone. So she decided to move to California to a facility that could help take care of her. Here she gets assistance with the basics, medicine, bathing, the meals are taken care of, and she's close to her daughter, Robin.
She was calling it the place for a while. I have to go back to the place now. You know, it wasn't her apartment, it wasn't home. So slowly you've started, yeah.
It took me a while to get adjusted. You know, it was a big move.
Anne gets Social Security and is eligible for veterans benefits to help pay some of the costs. She has savings, a condo she's trying to sell in Florida. With all of that, Robin says, they can probably maybe afford about 5 years here.
If my mother had come here sooner and wanted to live in assisted living sooner than now, I'm not sure financially how we would have pulled it off. You know, just looking at years and years of paying this, it's exorbitant. It's very high. But it provides an independence that's really important to people.
If the money runs out, Robin and Anne say they'll figure it out somehow.
I would depend on my children, but I wouldn't want to.
Why not?
Because I think that they have their own life to live, and it's not fair to put a burden on them at this point.
But they put a burden on you at some point. I mean, you raised them.
That's true. However, if I can deal with my finances as I have up until now, then it shouldn't be too hard. If I needed help, I'm sure they would help me.
Anne and Robin are lucky. A lot of people don't have a plan or a way to pay for these things. And adult children wind up in a situation where they have to budget fast.
It's incredibly difficult for people because it's usually precipitated by a crisis.
John Lansing is an elder care attorney in Pasadena.
So they're already in a state of shock and emotional trauma because they're usually coming from the neurologist's office where they just found out that mom has Parkinson's disease, or they're coming from the rehab center where dad's been transferred after 3 days in the hospital because of a stroke. So they're already completely stressed out and anxious and worried about everything. So it's hard to settle down and talk about money.
He says once you do start talking money, you start talking big numbers, really big numbers. In a dream world where I could just have an account with enough money so that when I got very old, I could be sure it wasn't straining my kids, what would that mean?
$500,000.
Really?
Yeah. If you figure that the cost of care for a nursing home is at least $100,000 a year, then $500,000 is a conservative estimate.
To be clear, nursing homes are the most expensive long-term care. And not every nursing home costs $100,000 a year. The national average is closer to $80,000. John says Medicaid can help pay once savings accounts have been drained. There are other government programs. But often the cost falls to families. John Lansing's own mom got sick when he was in law school. So sick that she needed long-term care.
It cost her every penny she had and whatever I could find and whatever I could, you know, beg, borrow, or steal. because you'll find that if you're ever in this position, you just cobble together a solution, whatever works.
And where did you beg, borrow, and steal from? Where were?
Well, I switched from the day program to the evening program at school, and for a while I had a day job. I borrowed money from a family member, money that is more of a gift than a loan, and just did what I could.
Assisted living facilities and other kinds of elder care just aren't affordable to many families, no matter how much begging and borrowing and stealing they do. The government estimates nearly 40 million people spend some amount of time taking care of an elderly relative or friend without getting paid for it. Back in Pasadena, Ann Somer didn't want to move in with her daughters. She's proud to be able to pay for this place and likes feeling independent.
I'm free to do whatever I want to. I don't have to answer to anybody. And I also have the luxury of having family here as well.
All of these arrangements, in-home and out of the home, put emotional stresses on families. But they also create new relationships with people in the new community and with people you've known, in some cases, your whole life. Ann and Robin seem to be navigating well.
It changed my relationship that Robin is more, she takes care of me more than the other way around.
And how does that feel?
It feels great. I'm the daughter and she's the mother. It's a funny feeling, really, but it's true that Robin is, she's responsible for me. She does so many things for me. She really does.
Do you ever say, I'm the mom? Absolutely not.
No, because I know she has my interest at heart. And I wouldn't want it any other way.
Taking financial care of elderly parents is one thing. But today's boomers are often helping out their kids and grandkids, too. So how many bills can they pay before they wind up in trouble? Well, we've got certified financial planner Luis Barajas with us to answer some of those questions. Luis, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Nice to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So how much better financial shape are grandparents in these days than their kids and grandkids?
Well, the grandparents are doing okay. The baby boomers are doing much better. They're earning more income. But the problem is now they're having a real tough situation in the sense that we've heard about the sandwich generation where the parents are having to take care of their parents and then their children.
Right.
Well, now, because of this great recession that we've just been through, now they're taking care of their grandkids as well. So it's really draining their income, their retirement income, and I think it's going to have a big impact down the road.
So we're talking about baby boomers whose parents are still alive, who have now
children
and grandchildren to take care of.
Right. I call it the club sandwich generation. You got to add another layer in there, right? So it's difficult. And what's happening is that a lot of baby boomers, I think the majority, don't have over $100,000 saved in their retirement accounts. So they're thinking about today's situation, but not really planning for tomorrow.
So it sounds like right now boomers are doing better maybe than anybody else, but they're still not doing great. Is that right?
That's correct. And again, you have to understand the way the current economy is. We have an 8.2% unemployment rate. But among teenagers, for example, there's a 24% unemployment rate. And so the grandparents are having to help these teenagers, sometimes just with gas money to help them get to school. We've got 5 million kids under the age of 18 living with grandparents right now.
Wow.
So we have to understand that the changing demographics in America and add the recession are really creating a burden to a lot of grandparents.
So how much should they be helping out?
You know, the problem is when you got grandkids, they pull on your heartstrings, right? I'm a
right.
grandfather as well. I've got a 3-year-old, and my little granddaughter comes to me and says, Papa, you know, can you get me this? And if I got a 20 in my pocket, I'm going to spend it. The problem is that they really need to do planning as to how long their money is going to last and how they're going to be able to take care of their medical bills down the road, long-term care costs. Those are things that they're not doing. And if they can keep one eye on today and one towards the future, it'll help out a lot.
And so how do grandparents avoid that heartstring tug when they have a grandchild who wants a little toy or a son or daughter who's actually in pretty dire financial situation?
Well, we have to be reasonable in the sense that, okay, so I'm a grandparent and I just can't indulge my children, my grandchildren. So I want to take a look at how I'm going to be spending my money. If it's really a need, like a medical need for my kid or some kind of school activity that they really should be in, I'm going to go out of my way and probably help them out. But if it's because my teenage grandson's coming to me and he needs a Dodge Challenger for his 16th birthday.
And who doesn't?
Right. That's a different story. Also, the valuable money lessons they can teach their grandchildren.
And what are those lessons?
Well, you want to teach the children how to save for the future. You want to teach the children patience. You want to teach the grandchildren discipline and delayed gratification. And so one of the things that I'd love to see grandparents do is say, okay, I'll help you out. But guess what? Come over to the house, clean out my garage. I'll give you a 20. Not only that, they understand the value of money, but they get to spend time with their grandparents, which is really important.
And how do you advise your clients to talk to their kids and their grandkids about that, about sort of why they can't help out with this house payment right
now? Well, that's the beauty of having a money talk with their children and their grandchildren about setting proper boundaries and proper expectations. Hey, I'm talking to my son and say, I can help you out with your daughter's education, but up to a certain amount of money. I can't go beyond that because I still have to continue saving for the future.
And again, I think it's a question that I keep coming back to, but when you're a grandparent and you do feel this need or want to help, but you also know you should be saving for retirement, for the fact that you're going to have lots of expenses and maybe not a lot of money coming in, how do you do that? I mean, how do you balance out sort of the emotional and the practical?
Well, you will never balance out the emotional and the practical unless you actually sit down and do a plan and actually can take a look at the real numbers in front of you. Because if you don't have that in front of you, don't know what's ahead of you, you will behave emotionally. And as we know, almost all financial mistakes are made based on emotion. It's either fear, greed, you know, and in this situation, fear, like if I don't help out my children or grandchildren, they're not going to love me. You get that a lot. And there's a lot of feeling of guilt of not helping out your grandkids. Also, a big fear is running out of money when you retire. And that's the number one fear, actually, for most baby boomers.
And I guess if my parents or grandparents run out of money, that's not going to be any good for me either.
Well, then you're stuck in that sandwich, maybe, you know, club sandwich. I don't know if there's another sandwich that's bigger than that. We can add another layer to that.
But as people live longer and longer.
That's right. And the problem is that we go from being independent to not interdependent, but very dependent on others. And we need to stop that cycle. And we need to start teaching people, again, to save for the future. And why not teach our grandchildren wonderful values as saving, patience, discipline, delayed gratification? Those are the things that you want to incorporate when you teach lessons to your kids.
Certified financial planner Luis Barajas is the author of 5 books, including My Street Money. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Finally, to great-grandmother Clara Kenuchari, probably America's oldest internet sensation.
Welcome to my kitchen. I'm Clara. I'm 91 years old. Today we are making meals from the Depression.
Her cooking videos focus on old-time recipes, and they've garnered more than 4 million hits on YouTube. Clara's now 97 years old and lives with her daughter-in-law Nancy in upstate New York. I asked Clara about one of her favorite things to cook, the poor man's meal.
Takes potatoes, hot dogs, onions, then we chop them all up fine and fry them. It's called a poor man's meal because it was very cheap to make. They were delicious, cheap and delicious. You should try them.
I will. Clara, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it was nothing. Thank you.
May I speak to Nancy?
Just a minute.
Hi.
Nancy, what have you learned from her?
Well, she's been an inspiration to me that, you know, in her 90s, she could, you know, still touch so many people's lives through her stories of the tough times and how she got through them. And people think, well, if she got through it, you know, we can get through it type of thing.
So. Nancy, thank you so much for your time. I do appreciate it.
All right. Bye.
You can find links to Clara's blog and the YouTube channel, Great Depression Cooking, at marketplace.org. And now I've got to get cooking myself. That's Marketplace Money for this week. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Next time, what does winning a medal at the Olympics mean for your finances?
So if you're in one of the big sports, let's say swimming, track and field, or gymnastics, you are much more likely to have not only significant deals offered to you, but to have longevity.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Joel Patterson. A special thanks this week to Chris Gutierrez of Southern California Senior Resources. Our theme was composed by Mark Govner. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is JJ Yore. I'm Adrienne Hill. Tess Vigeland is back next week, and we'll see you then. This is APM.